have a go for auto-sequence start. Discovery's onboard computers have primary control of all the vehicle's critical functions. T-minus 17 seconds and counting. 15. 12. 11. 10. 9. 8. 7. 6. Start. Start. 2. 1. Boost ignition and liftoff of the station.
The concept of time and space is one of mankind's great mysteries. When pondering what lies beyond the threshold of our atmosphere and further beyond our solar system, one begins to feel minuscule or even microscopic in juxtaposition. Our existence, trivial and superficial when assessed comparatively to the vast infinite sprawl of the universe. At an astounding 13.8 billion years old, the universe makes the average human lifespan look like a blip on the radar of our existence. But maybe, think of Earth as the organism that is defined by the sum of its parts, a bigger entity where mankind functions as a mass of its cell structure. Maybe it is only when we act on egocentricity and selfish impulses we become small. When we work towards the common goal of humanity, equality, in the preservation of our planet, we are vast and awesome. When we inspire others, we are infinite beyond the constraints of time. When we love and care for all living things, we accelerate at light speeds, and death and birth are but the means that our Earth regenerates. Space is where they told us heaven was.
They say that is 10 zillion light years away, and just the pure at heart will walk a righteous someday.
Initiating podcast system to more evil.
Welcome to Speak All Evil, the podcast you were warned about. I am the Trentacle. I'm here with Kevin, Dave, and Kat. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Trentacle.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Spaced out.
I got a little something I want to try tonight. You know, we talk a lot about practical effects versus digital effects in movies. So I want to run something by you guys real quick. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. This week...
Horror, spay.
Wow,
that's a real. That's just me. That's just me doing that.
You did that?
I could see it.
I did that just myself. No digital enhancements whatsoever. I can do one more.
Horror, spay.
Kind of sound like a Muppet.
Oh, but like a cool Muppet.
Yeah, it's a cool Muppet.
So this week, we're talking about horror in space, not to be confused with horror from space. Two very different things. A lot of horror comes from space. Less horror takes place in space. A lot of times in straight genre horror, the horror space movie is often the final frontier of a dying film franchise series. Examples like Jason X, Hellraiser Bloodline, Leprechaun 4 in space, which incredibly we're going to talk about.
Woo.
What else can we do with this character? I don't know. Put him in space.
float around a little.
Yeah, so that's a pretty important part of the horror genre. But there's a lot of more serious horror movies that take place in space, and just kind of dark, evil, and more ambiguous movies that have a space setting. So everybody chose something and watched something this week that was solidly in outer space. Dave, what did you choose this week?
I chose Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. This is my number one favorite movie of all time. And whoa, you're not going to get that again.
Hold on.
My number one favorite movie of all time.
Oh.
Wow. You sound like me.
Just because it kind of, it sinks in, you know, like over multiple watches. And I've watched it since I was a kid. And I still think it surpasses like a lot of space movies as far as realistic depictions of space.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'm spaced out tonight. I got
a little too high. I'm sorry, pal. This sucks. You may feel like you've gone permanently insane, or like you're dead. Here's the good news. You're alive, and your sanity is probably intact. You're just really, really high.
I watched a bunch of space movies. One of you guys should take over. I can't drive the spaceship. I'm going to pull the spaceship over, and then I'm going to just hand it over to Trent to talk a little bit about this movie, and I'm going to eat a piece of bread.
2001, A Space Odyssey. This is on HBO right now, on HBO Max, at least HBO Now. I don't really know the difference. I don't think HBO knows the difference. But 2001 is a movie that was always like on cable TV growing up when I was a kid. So I would see bits and pieces of it all the time and try to understand what was going on. And then I saw this for the first time, like as an adult, probably 15 years ago. And it totally blew me away. Like all of a sudden, all the years of seeing 2001 in a more passive way that I didn't quite understand. Not that I necessarily understand it all now, but I rented it and I was so blown away, and I haven't seen it since then. So it's been like 15 years since I saw the movie top to bottom. And I was blown away all over again. Like Dave said, I feel like, you know, I appreciate it more now than ever. It was a lot of fun. And I love how the movie starts with a very modest introduction setting titled The Dawn of Man.
Mm.
So it really takes you back right, to the very beginning. It's going to tell you the whole story.
Yeah, I had never seen this movie somehow.
Whoa.
I don't understand. What? I don't get it.
First, I know. I've never, you know, I don't know. I'm not like super familiar with all of Kubrick's stuff. In 2001 had just kind of slipped through the cracks. I mean, it's also, you know, 2.5 hours long, so it's a pretty big commitment. It's up for so much interpretation, and it's definitely a movie that you could watch it once a year, and depending on like where you are in your life or anything really, you could have a new interpretation of this movie every single time. It's amazing some of the set pieces he put together for this movie. This movie reminded me of like Pink Floyd. You know, the fact that it was made in 1968 and you go back and watch it in 2020 and it's like still looks great. It's almost like going back and listening to like Dark Side of the Moon and being like, how the fuck did they make an album that sounds this good that many years ago? And then just one tidbit for people who haven't seen it. This is a 2.5 hour movie and Kubrick manages to give us a whopping 40 minutes of dialogue. So you have 2 hours and 10 minutes of completely, you know, lack of dialogue, which normally...
And it's rated G. I think it's the only rated G movie we'll ever review on Speak All Evil.
Is it
rated
really?
G? Oh, wow. Interesting.
It's rated G. And it's terrifying. I thought it was terrifying.
I mean, yeah.
It is. I think it's very scary. We can... Kevin, the ending is somewhat ambiguous. I'll present mine, my idea later, but Kevin, what did you think about the ending?
I mean, I was all over the place. You know, I went deep into looking up this movie just because I almost had like, I guess the opposite of buyer's remorse. Like the fact that I'd never seen it before. So I was like, all right, I gotta go all in. I think it's a movie about God without being a religious film. I think there's alien connotations. I think, you know, you can take it to Homer's The Odyssey, you know, with some of the things that I was looking at. There's a million different interpretations of the ending. I don't necessarily think the ending is as important as the journey the movie takes you on. I think you have to view all, I think it's 3 or 4 acts in totality for when you get to the ending, as to what it means. I like the Homer comparison the best, in that I viewed it not as a journey, but almost as a homecoming. I think that the whole ending is talking about a homecoming of sorts, not someplace that we've reached.
I think it's like a power thing. It's like the invention of power or to conquer something. Because in the beginning, you have the primitive man kind of rises to the top of the food chain when he discovers a weapon in the presence of this, I don't know, this monolith is what they call it. It's a giant black spiritual shape. it gives off these like weird vibrations, and then later on, you know, the computer is doing the same thing. It's overtaking the man once it gets near the monolith. So I felt like that it was some sort of, I don't know, it makes you feel small in the concept of life and time and, you know, space, obviously.
I think I was in the same boat. I had never seen this movie all the way through because I would see little snippets, you know, on cable, or maybe one of my weird college friends had it playing at their house while other people were there. Who knows? But I feel like, especially with like older horror movies that we watch, I get very nitpicky. Like, I'm like, oh, it's so long. Oh, the dialogue's terrible, blah, blah, blah. But this is just... I want to say perfect film, but I'm sure, you know, there are things that you can nitpick, but just like the classical soundtrack, just like right off the bat, and then like there's no dialogue for the first 30 minutes. I like timed it because I'm like, nobody said anything for like a really long time, and like, what's going on? But it somehow works. Like, I was never bored while watching this movie. I got a little sleepy towards the end because I started a little late. I started at like 7 o'clock, so it was close to my bedtime. Yeah, when I was towards the end, so I was getting a little dozy.
Night owl.
You know, but it's very, for as scary as it is, it's also weirdly calming, and I think space is fucking terrifying. Like, that's my boyfriend Jimmy's favorite like genre, is like anything space related. That's what he wants to watch. But I don't like space, I don't like sad robots, so usually I'm like, I don't want to watch that movie. But he watched it with me because I don't think he had ever seen it, and when like the special effects were happening, he was like, when did this movie come out, like the late 80s, like when did it? I'm like, nah, this came out in 1968. Like, I guess, like, I'm assuming, like, the models, you know, they use, like, models instead of, like, CGI and all that stuff, and it was just so good. I would watch it 1,000 more times this week.
I feel like Kubrick is one of those directors that just kind of controls, like, your heartbeat, if you know, like, when you're watching his movies. He just demands that everything go at his pace. He dictates, like, and once you get into that pace, it's like really hypnotic. Mm-hmm. And like Kevin was saying, it is like a psychedelic album. And I think a lot of that void, that empty space with no dialogue, you know, sucks you into that. But
well, the soundtrack helps immensely too. And I noticed that was one of the first things that I noticed when I was watching it, is like an hour has gone by. A very slow, quiet hour, but it doesn't feel like it at all. It's like, it's a fun, exciting, interesting hour, even though it does move at a slow pace and there isn't a lot of dialogue, necessarily action happening. It's so well done that to me, the time flew by. I didn't feel like I was watching
the soundtrack is like happens. Classical music greatest hits.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can't really lose that. I mean, you could take, you know, a video of you taking a poop and put classical music over it, and people would be like, the soundtrack's good.
Please don't.
Yeah, it features Gheorghe Ligeti, who we talked about as not doing the music, but was featured in Killing of a Sacred Deer that we just talked about. It opens and closes with Thus Spake Zarathustra, which was done by Richard Strauss, but it was actually based on Nietzsche's work of the same name. And that whole Nietzsche work deals with kind of eternal recurrence of the same. the death of God, you know, as a parable, you know, and then speaking of Pink Floyd, they actually were signed on to do the entire soundtrack of the movie and backed out at the last minute for other commitments. But you can take their song Echoes and sync it with the Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite segment, and it lines up perfectly.
Wow.
Wait a minute. I thought that was the Wizard of Oz. I thought that was the Wizard of Oz. You sync up Darkseid to the Wizard of Oz. Now, I think that's an urban legend, Kevin. I don't think that's...
That's like an urban myth.
It used to be Wizard of Oz. You could sync
up to the Dark Side of the Moon. My 8th grade history teacher was a deadhead, and he showed it to us. It's not real.
Yeah, if you sync up a picture of space with any Pink Floyd album, yeah.
I think we just cancel the rest of the episode and try it. The rest of the episode will just be Pink Floyd.
You guys could try. I'm sorry that these like internet urban legends are getting picked up on the show. I don't want to propagate this kind of news out there.
She doesn't even know if it's real. She just feels like it's real because you want it to be real so bad.
It's real in my heart, so it's real in real life.
I like was cheering you on. Like, yeah, it's real. Fake news.
Fake news. What did you think of the ending, Trent? What was your hot take?
I don't know how hot it is, but I found I thought that the ending was one of menace to mankind and to Earth. Specifically, the very final shot of the movie, to me, does not portend well for mankind. And I thought that followed sort of. I felt like the whole thing was laying out the next step in human evolution, and the next step is a new kind of human, and that human is not going to be a pleasant experience for current humanity on Earth. I thought that it was not a happy ending, I guess. I would say, you know what I mean, that last shot of the I don't think I'm spoiling too much when I say the sort of the superhuman at the end, to me, with the eye open, it was an evil eye. I didn't notice it the first time I saw the film as an adult a long time ago, but I don't know, I didn't see anything good. I didn't think the intentions were like enlightening current humankind. I thought the intentions were the end of this. You know, like we're the apes essentially. Yeah. And you know, we're going to have to make way for the next.
That would make sense. Cause at the beginning it makes, you know, the apes murder each other. So it kind of makes sense that it would do the same at the end. Right.
Yeah. Maybe? The
those are people in suits.
Yeah. And
those are like,
sure.
So that it was this one dude,
mimes.
This one, yeah, he was a mime. Daniel Richter played like the leader of the tribe of ape men, and he was like a street mime at the time. He actually has a memoir out talking about his experience doing that, called Moonwatcher's Memoir.
Talking about it?
Yeah, you usually don't get too many mime interviews.
I said talking about it. I was making a.
Ew.
We should have a mime on the podcast.
I didn't think that the monolith inspired the apes to be murderous so much as the monolith, I felt like in the opening part of the movie, transferred knowledge to them to use tools. Like they could always fight, and because the first group of apes is displaced from their waterhole by a more dominant group of apes. And I thought that the monolith imparted to them the knowledge to be able to use a tool, and they figure out can use
the bones as a tool and they can beat their enemies that way. It gave them knowledge, and unfortunately we see what we do with knowledge, which is typically, you know, use it for something bad.
Every time I learn something, I try to do something bad with it.
It has
the
secret to win. You know what I mean? It has this the clue to win because, you know, Hal does the same thing. Hal gets that knowledge. That's what I took. Like when they get near the monolith.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a giver
knowledge
of knowledge
to overcome your, you know, to be dominant. But then again, then the duplicated selves through all different times at the end, and like the really nice furniture. That stuff was really confusing.
One thing that this movie has that a lot of space movies, especially the darker space movies, there's generally a lot of times there's a secret mission or a mission that is unknown to the crew of the ship, or a mission that begins as incidental. People think they're out in space doing one thing, and it turns out they were actually out in space doing something else that it was either kept from them or that came up in the course of whatever their mission was supposed to be. And it is really scary. Kat, you mentioned space being scary. I think it's really terrifying. A lot of these scenes, not only in this movie, but in all these movies, the idea of that endless vastness of nothing to be out there is like the scariest thing. I'm surprised there aren't more movies in space, because it is like the scariest thing in the world to me. Like, imagine you're just out there.
It's literally one of the few things that terrifies me. And I would like stay up all night thinking, but wait, how can space be infinite? Like, how can it be? I mean, it fucked me. Space is one of the most terrifying things for me to think about. And I guess to answer your question, I think there aren't a lot of movies in space because it's really fucking hard to make a good one. So I think when you do, it's highlighted pretty hard. Mm. You know, you look at Gravity, you know, some of the better space movies. I mean, I guess with all horror, you know, I guess horror as a genre is kind of the same thing. You could very easily make a bad horror movie. But I think that's why the movies like 2001, you know, Alien, some of the movies that are classics that take place in space, they're almost given like a little extra, you know, award because you made a good movie that takes place in, you know, the infinite beyond.
I've got a ticket to the moon. I'll be leaving here any day soon. Yeah. I've got a ticket to the moon, but I'd rather see the sunrise in your eyes. Got a ticket to the moon. I'll be rising high above the earth so soon, and the tears I cry might turn into the rain that gently.
Well, I wasn't about to put my name on a horror in space episode and not talk about Alien. The 1979 feature film debut. I believe it was the feature film debut of director Scott Ridley. Hey, Sharp, you guys are on top of it tonight. I just wanted to see. I'm pretty sure it's Scott Ridley.
Ridley.
Alien is regarded as one of the greatest films of all time by a lot of people. It's certainly one of the greatest horror movies of all time. A lot of people consider it science fiction. I don't really think this is a science fiction movie. The line kind of becomes blurred between the science fiction and horror genre, as we've talked about. This, to me, is solidly a horror movie. There isn't really any quote-unquote science fiction in it much. It just happens to take place in space. Features a lot of conventions that you find in these space movies, like I was talking about the ulterior mission. Also, this is the first one of the bunch that has the cowboy character on the crew. There's no cowboy in 2001, but most space movies, you have a crew of people on a ship, and there's always a cowboy character, so that at some point in the movie, someone can say to that character, hey, no cowboy stuff on this one. And you have that in Alien. It's a very important, very important part. I love this movie. It reminds me a lot of The Thing, or I should say The Thing reminds me a lot of this. You have the small crew of people in a remote outpost. They're out there. There's no authority that's going to help them. They're confined in a, I guess the ship isn't necessarily small, but it's certainly confined space with each other, and stuff starts going haywire, and there's nowhere to run, and there's no answers, and they can't even necessarily trust each other. So it was a lot of fun to watch this again. This is one that I probably watch every few years or something like that.
Yeah, I watched this immediately after I watched 2001, so I'm now going to spend however long we talk about Alien trying to convince you guys that Ridley Scott was heavily influenced by Kubrick's 2001. Maybe it's just because I watched them back to back. I really don't think you have Alien if you don't have, you know, 2001. You've got Mother on the Nostromo, the ship, who was reminiscent of HAL. You've got this, you know, mission that they're not quite sure where they're going. Only one person, you know, really knows what's up. But you're right, with a much bigger emphasis on horror and probably a little bit of The Thing mixed in. The movie was written by Dan O'Bannon, who has quite the career. And he basically admitted when he was asked, you know, what movies did you rip off for this? He said, I'll admit, I didn't rip off one thing. I ripped off everyone. You know, he cited The Thing from Another Planet, which Carpenter then developed into The Thing. And to play on the cowboy thing, I wrote down when I was watching, like this is almost like a space Western, where you have like the almost mm-hmm. like these long haul truckers in space, you know, these like the working class space people that come across, you know, obviously one of the greatest monsters of all time. But anyway, I'll stop that rant and just say this is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I actually went and watched every single Alien movie in succession. And I would highly recommend it because Fincher's Alien 3 is not as bad as we remember. Alien Resurrection is actually not terrible. And then watching them all in succession, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, I really appreciated a lot more the second time around and watching them back to back.
I think this is my all-time scariest movie monster. I still have nightmares about Alien because I was a latchkey kid, so I would watch whatever the fuck I wanted when I was younger. And I was like, yeah, this looks cool. And then, nope, fuck that. Still have nightmares. I like the fourth one, Resurrection. I think I watched that one the most when I was younger. I don't know why, but we can talk sequels later. I love Ripley. That's like, you know, Scream Queen, but like Monster Hunter Scream Queen. I don't know if they have an.
I think it's Ridley.
Ripley? Wait, no. Fuck off. I hate you. I'm like, oh, sorry. Whoops. Oh, Lake Bottom?
Oh, it's Ripley.
Yeah, totally.
It's Ripley.
Ripley Scott.
Sigourney Weaver. Ripley is trying, like, could have saved everybody in the beginning because she was on board. Quarantine rules. She would know what to do right now. She would stay home and not cough into people's areas.
That's true. You know, I love Alien. Thanks for reminding me to rewatch it. I hadn't watched it in a while. You know, 2001, there's hardly any dialogue, like we said, but it's also a very isolated experience. There aren't really no relationships in that space. In Alien, what I liked about it is, like the thing, it focuses on the relationships and the trust between the characters, and you know the guys that are gonna make like the wrong choice, and they're talking loud and saying nothing, and it's really frustrating. Probably I think the scariest horror movie in space.
It's terrifying. What was you guys' reaction the first time you saw the chest?
Oh, even before the chest burster, I think the first time you see a face hugger is still one of the scariest moments in movie history. Yeah. I was watching this with my daughter, and I like jumped and screamed, even though I knew what was going to happen when the egg opened. I've seen this movie a million times. I still was like, ah! And my daughter was just laughing at me, like, wow, Dad, you ever seen this before?
The monster has a grill. You know what I mean? It's like, it was very ahead of its time with that, for sure.
The chest burster, very similar to the chest burster in The Thing. Almost the same scene, and it's a great one. But one of the many things that this movie does that I like that becomes kind of a classic for space movies is there's the central computer of the ship called Mother. It's sort of not as smart, I guess, as Hal. But most of these movies, there's always this central computer system running things. And I really like the vision of what, you know, the future of computers on spaceships would be. You can just type in open-ended questions into it. Like, there's always, all these movies have a scene where they're like, they go to the computer and they're like, how to defeat alien? Type in, you know, question mark. And it's like, does not compute. Let's see. Alien origin computer. Not sure. No answers there. This computer doesn't know anything.
It's like us when we were like 16 and discovered the internet. You'd just be like www.hell.com. does not exist.
The vision of the future was Ask Jeeves. You know, like, let's see how to remove face hugger? ? No. Also, I like the grumpy maintenance crew. You have, is it Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton, the two-man maintenance crew that spends their normal time below deck working on stuff, and they're always complaining about, you know, their pay and working overtime and all this stuff. That's kind of a fun part.
Hey, the cat, was his name like Jones?
Mr. Jones. Cat.
Oh, yeah. Tell us your joke there.
I didn't have any joke.
You wrote a joke? Yeah, I wrote a joke.
I did, actually. The cat keeps running away over and over again. If you've freshly watched the movie like you guys had, it really worked the best. It might not work on everyone, but so they're always trying to find the cat. They're always trying to find the cat. And like I said, why does the cat and alien always keep running away? And the answer was Tom Skerritt.
Oh,
the highlight. This is a highlight of Tom Skerritt's career. The joke was the highlight of his career. But before that, it was Alien.
He's so young in this. I feel like Tom Skerritt did this movie and then did his next movie 20 years later. Like, I don't remember Tom Skerritt. I don't remember looking like this.
He like turned into the dude at the end of 2001.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Tom Skerritt found the monolith. If people really want to get into the movie Alien, there's an entire Reddit subthread that is insane. One of them does compare 2001 and Alien pretty extensively. There's also a book from Jeffrey Ewing, Kevin Decker, and William Irwin called Alien in Philosophy that explores way more than anyone probably ever needed to explore.
I think that Mother and Hal should hook up.
Kevin, you can just jump right in. I don't think I need to ask you what you picked.
Affirmative.
Wow, that was very, very dismissive.
I just feel really fake when I'm always like, so what did you pick? Like, I know what you picked. I watched it twice. Like, I'm asking you what I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you guys, I think you two need some space.
No,
space.
I just feel... No, you know what I think it is? I think it's the atmosphere. It's just something.
This week, I lost, once again, my whiskey pick. And just, like, immediately went with 1997's Paul W.S. Anderson-directed Event Horizon. This is a movie that came out at a time in my life when I was consuming, like, anything that would come out horror-wise. But this is also the movie that, strangely, for like a lot of parties in like my late teens and like early 20s, you know, it was like a party's winding down. Someone wants to throw on like a scary movie or something. For some reason, Event Horizon was like my main cruise, like go to. So I've watched this movie in the theater in the middle of the day and probably like 25 times between the hours of like 3 and 6 in the morning. But I remembered really, really liking it, and I wanted to see how it held up because it's been a long time. It doesn't hold up great, and I never realized that Paul Anderson directed it. And I think if I had known that, I would have probably gone into the fetal position and had whiskey pick this week again. Paul Anderson sucks. You know,
what else has he done?
He is. Yeah. Well, the Resident Evil movie series.
Oh, right.
Which, again, I'm not a gamer, but Resident Evil was my jam because it was a horror video game. And for him to end up with that franchise in his hands, you know, basically what I think Paul Anderson did is he looked at Alien and Aliens and said, what if I just like threw in some theology and made a mashup of this? It'll be a smash hit. And it wasn't. I will say, you know, so the whole point of the movie is a ship disappeared years ago on a mission. The ship had this reactor that was supposed to like emulate a black hole or something. And then all these years later, it reappears. And the creator of the black hole generator or whatever hops on a ship with a crew that's going out to see what the hell happens, and shit goes real bad. What did you guys think of this?
Listen, I like a good bad horror movie, but I had very high hopes for this movie because it's one of Jimmy's favorite movies, and he was always trying to get me to watch it. And I would make it not very far into it, and then I'm like, I gotta do the dishes, or someone's knocking at the window, I gotta go. But I sat through the whole thing, and I didn't think it was that bad. Comparatively, I had just watched the Leprechaun movie, so my hopes were, you know, the level was not hard to reach to be better than that. But I thought it had one scary moment for me that I was like, ooh, and that was when they showed like video of like the past crew of like the Event Horizon. Mm. I thought it got a little scary there. Yep. It got like very like graphic and like gory.
Yes.
And I had a ooh there, but the rest of it I was just like, what is the guy from Jurassic Park doing on this ship? Is he a baddie? Maybe. Could be a baddie. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I did the same exact order as you. I did Leprechaun 4 in space first, and then I watched mm-hmm. this. So pretty much being deprived during that experience really lent... This movie didn't have big shoes to fill. Green slippers to fill. I don't know. We'll get into Leprechauns later. But I don't know. It wasn't as bad. I had remembered not liking it. I had done the same thing. This is one of those movies that you're like, oh yeah, oh space, do Event Horizon, check that out. It's a great movie. And then you haven't seen it for like 17 years. And I think I recommended it to Caitlin, and then was kind of really not into it. Sometimes when you present a movie like that, you feel like an obligation, and when it lets you down, you're like, fuck. So I felt like that about this, and so I went with low expectations. But I thought it was pretty fun. It got a little convoluted at the end. I didn't really understand what the Latin had to do with anything, and gravity.
I thought it was so
I didn't know gravity.
When they were talking about, he's like, liberate me. I'm like, it's liberate me. It's not... What do you mean? What is someone being like? What does that mean? It's like, right. What do you mean? What does it mean? You don't need to speak Latin to know what liberate me means. Like,
it's in a French accent. Wait a minute.
Someone comes up to you. You work at Burger King. They're like, le chicken sandwich. I have no idea what you say. I have no idea what you say.
I had never seen this. I thought that this, when Kevin said Event Horizon, I thought he was talking about the movie Pitch Black with Vin Diesel on the planet with all
same vibes,
the bat monsters. And I was kind of excited, like, you know, I remember that being actually not that bad for a low rent C-list horror movie. And then so I started watching this thinking like, oh yeah, that had like cool bat monsters in it, like it's not gonna be that bad. And I watched it the first time. It's on Netflix right now, so it's an easy, no extra charge. And pretty quickly into it, I was like, wait a minute, this isn't the movie with Vin Diesel and the bat monsters. I was like, all right, that's cool. And then I hated it, like, more than any, I wasn't really in the frame of, sometimes I just don't have the patience for something that is so bad. But I watched it again after that, last night or the night before, I watched it again. And I liked it a lot more the second time. And I think the thing with this movie is, last night when I watched it, I decided that I was just going to like make dinner and have food. And like, you know, I try not to like do other things when I'm watching movies because I don't like to be distracted. I like to really try to go on this voyage. But I think this movie is best if it like treat it like cable TV in the 90s when like this was just the movie that was on the most desirable thing out of all the channels that you just leave on. And like when you get up and you know, take a piss or whatever, you don't have to pause it. If you need to like go get a snack and get some crackers or something, cut some cheese up, you don't need to pause it. It doesn't matter if you leave the room for a minute. You could just have it on. Maybe you got a guitar in your lap and you're messing around with some stuff. you can answer text messages, you know, see dudes. You can, like, you know what I mean? You can do a couple tweets.
You experience it, like, peripherally.
This is very specific.
Yeah, you're not going to miss anything. So if you do it like that, there's just enough scenes. Like, Kat, you brought up the film from the original ship that they're looking for. That was kind of cool. And you're like, oh, it's a guy on fire or something. Oh, he's his eyes are torn out. And then you're like, wait, Pinhead is in this. Oh, it's Pinhead. So if you watch it like that, I actually liked it kind of the second time when I didn't have to care about anything and I could just take in some cool stuff. Like the cowboy character in this, we talked about Yaphet Kotto as the cowboy character in Alien. This has a cowboy character among the crew, and his name is actually Cowboy. I think they call him, although they call him the Funky Space Cowboy. Isn't that what they call him at the beginning?
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, that's the Funky Space Cowboy. And then sure enough, later on, he gets the warning, no cowboy stuff on this one. And my favorite thing about that character is at the beginning of the movie, they're all in these liquid tanks. They've been isolated in these liquid tanks for I don't know how long. And they all get dumped out of the tanks and they're all wet and in their underwear. And as soon as the space cowboy is out of his tank, while people are getting dressed, he's been asleep in this for who knows how long. The first thing he does is get right to the sexual harassing and harasses the lady right next to him.
Love
That's
it.
Like the
yes.
first thing that happens. And
right off the bat.
Yeah, it's supposed to be really funny. Like you just woke up from a space tank and you got a guy harassing you right away. You shouldn't even have her clothes on yet. So that was kind of cool. Kevin, I came around on this one a little bit.
You can watch this like peripherally. Like it's, you ran in, you were flipping through HBO and The Craft was on. You're going to stop and watch The Craft. And some of the problems are when you like are engaged for a moment and you go for the Latin. So like Kat, you latch on to this, you know, oh my God, what are they speaking? This must have some super deep meaning. But I will say this in defense of this, in this film and I guess Paul Anderson, even though I just shit all over the guy, this movie was super rushed because James Cameron was making Titanic at the same time that Paul Anderson was making Event Horizon. And Cameron went to Paramount and said, we have to push back Titanic. So Paramount went to Anderson and said, you got to finish Event Horizon because we need something to take the place. So he kind of rushed the movie, but what he did is he submitted an over 2-hour director's cut. And the studio came back and said, no, we need something like way more cut down and way more mainstream. So what happened to Anderson's original cut of the film is the studio neutered it. So like the orgy scene that you're talking about, Kat, when they discover this, you know, this movie of what happened to the original crew of the Event Horizon, that was actually much longer. All of the previous footage in the Latin was much more
fleshed out. What was longer? What was fleshed out?
Anderson actually hired amputees and porn stars to do like those sections of the film so that it looked more real. And they made him cut a bunch of this stuff out. So I think at the end of the day, when you watch the movie, you're left with a lot of questions, but I think that there's the possibility that Anderson's original cut may have answered a lot more of the questions instead of just focusing on the jump scares and like the quick, you know, classic late 90s, you know, quick flash cut edits. And the kicker is the movie bombed at the box office. It barely made half its budget back, but it got a cult following on home video. And so Paramount went back to Anderson and said, hey, can you grab that director's cut that you had and let's release that on DVD? Well, back in the 90s, like director's cuts and Blu-rays and director's commentary, they weren't a big thing. So the studio had actually never saved any of his footage that got cut out of the movie. So he actually couldn't go restore it. Anyway, that's my quasi defense.
They find a dead body from a crew member on the Event Horizon, and one of the people says they see the dead body is floating around, and someone says, "It looks like it was an animal or something got to him," and it doesn't look anything like an animal got to him. Like the corpse, it looks like it was boiled alive, or he was in an explosion. His whole body is burnt to a crisp, and I was thinking, like, what animal? It doesn't look like an animal. Like, I, like a radioactive school of piranha got to him. Would have to be the animal?
I mean, I will say this movie actually did, for me at least, have some like legit scares. Like, there's the scene where they're like crawling in the, you know, the ducts, and like the lights are flashing. I mean, like, there were actually some like legit scare moments for this in me. I just, you know, you look at a lot of, you know, director's cuts, or you hear about a movie that was censored, and it's like they had to take out 2 minutes and 37 seconds. I mean, Anderson had 34 minutes cut from what he submitted to the studio. I mean, yeah, thank God, or maybe not. Maybe the whole thing would have made a lot more sense. I will say this. This is the second time that Sam Neill, as you referred to him, Kat, the Jurassic Park guy, this is the second movie of his that I would have fought to the death for, like back in the 90s and early 2000s, that I've gone back to and been like, ah, fuck, I was wrong. And the other one would be John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness.
I think I like this better. I think I like this one better than In the Mouth of Madness in retrospect, now that I've seen it a couple times.
Mm.
And Sam Neill basically just turns into Pinhead at the end. Do you notice how close he was to Pinhead? In space.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Anderson's style is to just be very, very lenient with what he's borrowing from.
Well, I read some stuff where he talked about he wanted to do a haunted house in space instead of having an alien life form or something like that. He kind of wanted it to feel like the ship was haunted, which I sort of have a problem with. I don't like earthly horror just slapped into space. Like, why would, like, haunted in space? Why would a ghosts be hanging around in space? How, like, why is hell? I don't know. Just like ghosts in space. I don't really get it.
There's some legit people that worked on this movie, like the cinematographer alone, Adrian Biddle. He worked on Alien. He worked on Aliens. I mean, he did fucking The Princess Bride. Like, it's not like they didn't have like the money behind this or like the crew behind this. So I think every segment I'm flip-flopping back and forth of being like defending the movie and then being pissed about it.
The ending is great. I love the whole ending sequence. It was scary and kind of like it sort of surprised me. I totally bought it. So that was cool, I thought.
So I went with the critically acclaimed, podcast acclaimed, Leprechaun 4 in space.
Space. Where does it take place?
Space.
One small step for man, one giant leap for terror. Was the tagline. Which doesn't even. He's not going to have any giant
tagline
because he's a leprechaun.
Such a bad tag.
The premise of the film, of this cinematic masterpiece, is an evil leprechaun abducts an alien princess to marry her and become the supreme leader. And then space soldiers, I'm assuming American, because someone talked about Detroit at one point, which I thought was interesting because we don't know their origins. Anyway, they try to thwart his plan. I have some questions to begin. One, how did he get to space? He's just there in space. We don't really need a setup.
They never tell you.
No.
Never tell you. The same director did Leprechaun 3 that did Leprechaun 4. And it was like he ended 3 and was just like, well, where are we going to go now, guys? Fuck it.
I mean, there's so much I feel like I could talk about, but I think the most important thing I want to talk about is a man somehow birthed the leprechaun out of his penis. And I think that was really the highlight of the whole hour and a half film for me.
That was their chest burster scene.
And I appreciated that.
It was a crotch burster. They went crotch burster. Kat, I can answer you. This is like the only thing that interested me about this whole movie, okay. So I can answer you that question. when the leprechaun's head was severed, and they cut the leprechaun up somehow, and his head was just laying there. The astronaut, the crew member, peed on him. He whipped out and he peed all over the leprechaun's head. While he was peeing on the leprechaun's severed head, the leprechaun's energy somehow went up through the pee. They show it go
essence.
Up. Yes, went up through the pee and into the astronaut's penis crotch and gave him some sort of leprechaun STD. And then from there, the leprechaun grew and then burst out from his crotch later.
And apparently it took a little sexual excitement to make it happen, because he didn't burst from the penis until the guy was like starting to get some action. So I think we needed a little catalyst there for the leprechaun to perform his crotch bursting.
I understood how the crotch bursting happened. I just didn't know how he ended up in space. I saw the essence, you know, travel to the ding dong, but I didn't. I just don't understand why he knew about an alien space princess to begin with. There are a lot of plot holes. I'd say there are some plot holes. Surprisingly,
there's every kind of hole. Every kind of hole you could possibly have in a movie. This movie has all of them. The set looks like an amusement park at best. I have to be fully honest. I was torn this week. I didn't finish Leprechaun 4.
What?
Oh,
I watched.
Wow.
Well, what happened? Listen. Don't hang up on me. I watched it all the way up until the penis bursting thing. I fell asleep. I had
that was
a
like 20
trial.
Minutes in.
I had a trial. No, well, maybe it was further than that. I was at least 40,
Continue.
50 minutes in. I was a good ways through it. I had to cancel my subscription because we took the week off. I got lost. Oh my God, I have to watch that. And I couldn't. And I couldn't rent it again without getting another trial, but I couldn't get another trial. Tried to hack it on my computer. And I probably have all these viruses now, all these weird places I went to try to watch this movie. And I pieced together some of the clips. But my favorite thing about the movie as I'd seen it, and I really didn't want to set a precedent for not finishing movies, because it's really doesn't matter what movie, that's not cool. But I was like, you know, do I tell the truth or do I try to fake my way through Leprechaun 4, which would not be hard.
I was going to say.
I'm glad you came forward with the truth. And the thing is, I watched the whole thing, and after it was over, I was like, I can't imagine like one sentence that I would say about this movie. Like, so it doesn't really matter.
I was enjoying just getting the ammunition for how much it sucked. It was like, it's like you're collecting like cool looking shells on the beach. And then all of a sudden, oh my God, look at these beautiful diamonds. Just load them into this bag, because there was lots of
blue diamonds, green clovers,
slinging.
Kat accomplished one thing this week. This is the first movie that we've covered that I literally barely have one page of notes on. So for instance, on like 2001 A Space Odyssey, I had six full-size notebook pages. Leprechaun 4, yeah, I didn't. I mean, it has a lot going for it. It has a 0% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Zero percent?
On 0%. On other sites, it has an average rating of 1.5 out of 10. The director, Brian Trenchard-Smith, he's an English-Australian filmmaker and author. He has credits like Leprechaun 3, Night of the Demons 2. He has a massive filmography of low-budget and direct-to-TV videos, and Quentin Tarantino has said he's one of his favorite directors. I will say one thing. I was like, man, this is a largely unknown cast, but if you guys remember Sergeant Metalhead, that's Tim Colcheri. He was Hooker in Full Metal Jacket, who yelled the famous lines, "Get some," and "Ain't War Hell."
Oh, wow.
True.
Which, at the 55-minute mark of Leprechaun 4, he yells, "Get some." And oddly enough, this guy was actually supposed to play Sergeant Hartman in Full Metal Jacket, but in the 11th hour was replaced by Arlie Ermey. And I was watching him and I was like, dude, this guy is like if Henry Rollins and Chop Top from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 had a baby, like on fucking steroids.
I was looking forward to this when Kat first mentioned it. I was like, oh, yes, that's great, because we're already going to talk about 2001. We're going to talk about Alien. We're going to talk about some heavy hitting stuff. It'll be nice to lighten the mood a little bit and talk about something not quite as dense. And I thought it was going to be like so bad it's good, like a trauma type film or something like that. And I was like sort of rubbing my hands together as though I had some popcorn in front of me, like, this is going to be pretty funny stuff, Leprechaun 4 in space, right? So ridiculous. I can't believe it. But I was just like painfully bored. Like, it just hurt to sit there and nothing was happening and wasn't funny. I was like, when will it end?
I'm so sorry. It was basically just an hour and a half of toxic masculinity. Like, it was just all the dudes just being like, my dick's big also. Like, it was basically like you take the cowboy guy from Event Horizon and just carbon copy that. Like,
I remember liking the nightclub. There was like a nightclub on the spaceship or wherever they were. That was kind of like
vaporwave. It was nice.
Yeah.
You've also got like the few female actresses that are in it. One of them was the Tool Time girl from Home Improvement.
Oh, good for her.
But we can't forget the actual Leprechaun himself, which is Warwick Davis. Yeah. Willow, Ewok, Harry Potter.
He's the dude from Willow, the Mad Madigan. Like, he's that guy? is that him?
Mad Madigan. Just say that again. So Warwick Davis, he had a steady paycheck for 7 Leprechaun movies, which I think is there's 8. He dropped out 2 years ago for
I hate to correct you on the Leprechaun franchise, Kevin, but I think he was only in 6 because the 7th one was the reboot, and then there was one more after the reboot. He wasn't in the reboot. Origins is 2014, and then there was one in 2018. Well, I think we can get it right. Leprechaun Origins was the 7th Leprechaun movie. 2014 was the reboot with a darker tone. It didn't star that guy. And then there was one more in 2018, very recently. We'll have to, well, maybe we'll do a whole double episode on all the Leprechaun movies. And
that'd
really
be fun.
Get to the bottom of it.
It did launch a pre-nose job Jennifer Aniston's career.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about the first one. We're talking about Leprechaun 4.
Well, maybe
in
we
space.
Should.
I think that every time I've seen Leprechaun, it's been in a bar on St. Paddy's Day, just on the screen. And I just see little bits and pieces of it. I just see a few deaths, and I'm just like, this movie rules. But, you know, when you actually sit down to watch it and you're not at a bar and you didn't get the one with Jennifer Aniston in it.
Kevin, did you look up any of the folklore that the Leprechaun was
yes,
based on?
Let's go.
Do you have any poems? Do you have any limericks?
Irish accent.
There once was a green man in space.
Oh my God.
This is a rental, by the way. I paid for this one out of my pocket. This isn't on any of the streaming platforms.
What's next week?
Guillermo del Toro. We're going to be talking about the films of Guillermo del Toro. We're going to spotlight The Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, and The Shape of Water.
Hell, he's allowed to live in limbo and purgatory, so he knows the nine circles of hell better than anybody and often guides people who are going through that. And I just thought a lot of the theological references were really cool. You know, when they're going through, like, I think he refers to like the Elysian fields. I loved anytime the scythes were going in the fields, that if you notice, anytime that happens, that Matt Dillon or Jack, he just stops and is like, it's the only time that he's like calm and like contemplative. So there's a lot of references that you can dig into theologically. But I thought it was interesting that of all the people that Von Trier brings up in this, Verge, obviously Dante, the poet Blake, that he leaves out Milton in Paradise Lost. That's the most obvious one to me. So I thought it was curious that he left out any references to Paradise Lost. But he did make sure to have Verge quote Jim Morrison, and he asked Jack, "Do you want me to show you the way to the next whiskey bar?"
Yeah, right. Although I think Morrison took that from a traditional like folk number, but he also talks about Hitler and Mussolini and Pol Pot and all of like the great evil figures of the world, and as Jack describes them, us who create real icons of this planet. It's, you know, a lot of this is like, it's very trolly also. Like, there's a whole montage of other Lars von Trier films leading up to this. There's clips from Melancholia and Nymphomaniac. I just watched both of them because this sent me on a whole bender, and Antichrist and other ones. And so it's like, you know, he's a real troll. And so I think a lot of this movie is he's sort of trolling his own filmmaking history. And that's why you get that montage, and you get the stuff about the iconography or the of Nazi Germany. And, you know, he had, the reason he was banned from Cannes for so long before this movie was like comments that he made in jest about that. So there's a lot of wink nudge stuff going on too.
Yeah, I always wondered if this is him not just trolling, but basically saying, you know, he's kind of resigned to the fact that he's going to end up in hell. Or maybe at best, he hopes he ends up in purgatory and doesn't make the same decision that Jack makes when he reaches the end of his journey through the nine circles of hell. Or you could be right, Trent. He could literally just be making this movie to say, fuck off, everybody. You know, here's who I am.
I think it's both. all the above.
What was that about?
It was an artist.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
That they like the classic piano.
Well, they try to talk about it like it's art, because like you were saying, Trent, when Jack goes on that whole rant about icons, and he's talking about, you know, some of the real tyrants in history, Virgil's next speech tells him about that concentration camp, Buchenwald, and he starts talking about how there was a tree in the middle of that concentration camp, where allegedly Johann Wolfgang Goethe wrote some of his most important works while sitting under the tree before this was a concentration camp. So I think von Trier was kind of trying to tie in or bring Jack around to be like, no, like there's some real art, you know, surrounding some of this bullshit and some of this tragedy, and definitely not agreeing with Jack and his, you know, calling these people icons and trying to call what he does art.
Yeah.
I was really disappointed that he didn't get to finish his final work when he's got everything. He wants to do the Full Metal Jacket, the one bullet thing. But, you know, I just was like, oh, you can at least just squeeze it off before this next segment, at least finish the work. And he didn't. I guess he did build the house, though.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It involves a taxidermied child. We can say Grumpy the child who's taxidermied with a wide grin.
That will haunt my dreams forever. Absolutely. He does go on this really weird tangent too. I feel like towards the end when he starts talking about like what he quote, he's like, why is it always the man's fault? And like starts talking about like masculinity. And like, this is obviously, I feel like Jack's serial killing ways kind of started with a masculinity issue. Cause just looking at his, you know, his first victim, he doesn't snap until she calls him a wimp. And then
that's right.
Like,
that's right. Yes.
And I feel like that's the downfall from there.
Yes, that's right. He does. Right. He's really, it's when she challenges him that he is too weak and pathetic to be a serial killer. This is like the first scene. So we're not giving anything
Jack
away. Yeah. Don't
takes
challenge
the
him.
Jack and Jacks her.
Yeah. The house that Jack built is on Showtime. It's on Prime with Showtime. I rented it on Vudu. I think it's on most of the rental platforms. So pretty easy one to see.
You know, I think sometimes we all really need to look within, you know, like deep inside and ask ourselves, what's in the box? What's in the box? I fucking love Seven. It's so good. This is one of my movies. It's kind of like a Silence of the Lambs for me, where I'll just throw it on whenever, when I'm just like, oh, I don't know what to watch. I'll just, some light watching, I'll just watch Seven. David Fincher, 95, watched this bad boy on Showtime Plus or whatever the fuck. And then you can rent it anywhere, though, because it's still a very relevant movie.
It's out there.
You got Morgan Freeman. You got Brad Pitt, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kevin Spacey, that guy that usually yells in like army movies.
Arlie Ermey.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, for both. This is like, I would say for me, this is like a perfect serial killer movie in the way that the serial killer is very smart, very calculated, very patient. Everything that he wants to happen happens and everyone else in his little game or like his little pawns. But also, if you didn't have the good, like the Morgan Freeman, like the smart detectives doing their part, none of this would work. So it's like that give and take of like not like of competent detectives with this crazy theological serial killer. It's just great. I am upset that some people didn't really like this film because I thought this was like a very easy, crowd pleasing, go to serial killer film.
You're feeding you.
Oh, well, yeah.
I like this is a comedy for me. It's like I watch this. I can most enjoy this as like a parody of Law and Order. I saw this back like in the early aughts, and I really didn't like it. I guess The End a Mile Away. Not that it makes any sense, but I love. First of all, I really dislike the acting of Morgan Freeman across the board. Oh. I don't like him in any movie. It's just, he's very one note to me. He just has this thing that he does. And like, it's very annoying to me. So my favorite parts of this movie were like his little one liners, like his wisdom, like he's preaching, like, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. He's quoting the Bible. Good. You're real Sherlock Holmes over here. But my favorite one of all, he has many of these, cause that's what he does in these movies, is, when the model, there's a scene where a model has been dispatched by the killer, and he's going through the seven deadly sins, if you don't know the conceit of this movie. So she's representing the pride killing, and the medical examiner is looking at the body, and the killer has cut off her nose. And so Morgan's standing there, and the medical examiner says, "He cut off her nose." And Freeman goes, "The spider face." And I'm like, this is the funniest fucking serial killer movie of all time. Kevin, what do you think?
I don't think it's going to shock anybody that I've watched this movie probably like 25 times in my life. I love this movie. It is very buddy cop setup. You've got Morgan Freeman as the cliche about to retire guy. Yes, you've got Brad Pitt as the overeager newcomer.
You know some shit's going to go down.
You know that Morgan's not going to be able to retire. You know he's going to be trying to calm this kid down. Here's the thing that I realized watching this movie this time, because it's been quite a few years since I've seen it. The whole movie, you're watching Morgan Freeman as though he's the mentor of Brad Pitt. And you're kind of like, okay, Brad Pitt's the puppy dog. But I watched this movie this time. I think that Brad Pitt is actually spending the entire movie like unknowingly mentoring Morgan Freeman. And that's simply because I'd never really paid attention to the last line of the film, not the Hemingway quote that Freeman gives. But Arlie Ermey is asking Morgan, as Brad Pitt is meeting his fate, you know, and Morgan Freeman this whole time has been like, "I'm leaving this shit city. I'm going to a cabin in the woods." And then the captain's like, "Well, where are you going to be at, Somerset?" And Morgan Freeman says, "I'll be around." So I think like sort of I'd always watched this like, Brad Pitt didn't just learn his lesson. But I actually kind of think that he was unintentionally spending the movie, you know, kind of changing Morgan Freeman's perspective, which he spends, you know, the whole 2 hours saying he will never change. I love this movie. I think, Dave, you're right. The one thing I would say is that some of the 90s effects are super glaring. You know, having the band Coil cover Nine Inch Nails closer for the opening credit sequence is like as 90s as you can get. But look, Fincher considers this his first movie, because his first actual movie was Alien 3, which if you ever want to waste 2 hours of your life, read about the making of Alien 3 and what David Fincher went through. So for him to bounce back like this, because he didn't even want to make movies anymore, he was quoted as saying he'd rather have colon cancer than make another Hollywood movie.
Oh.
And then again, I think the script, I think Andrew Kevin Walker deserves a lot of credit. It took him 2 years to write this script. It's a very, I think, clever movie. Trent, you probably disagree. I love like the way that you don't know who the serial killer is until he decides to make himself known to you. And I also think the marketing of this was brilliant in that they never even marketed the actual actor that played the serial killer, because he's a pretty well-known actor and they didn't want you to know. They didn't want to detract from it.
yeah,
literally.
You gotta call Kevin Spacey for that. Big surprise.
Yeah.
I liked you, Kevin. You were talking about the buddy cop. I mean, when I say like, I mean like when you like something really ridiculous and funny. The buddy cop thing. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen True Colors, or not Cyndi Lauper song. it's the movie Colors with Robert Duvall and Sean Penn. Sean Penn and Robert Duvall, they're the cops fighting the gangbangers in L.A., and Ice-T does the soundtrack song,
Ooh.
Colors. You remember that? So it's the same thing. Bob Duvall is the old grizzled veteran, and Sean Penn is a young buck, and they call him Pac-Man because he's so excited to go. And it's the same. It's a very well-worn buddy cop thing. The old guy, the young guy. Yeah, same thing. But I really liked when they were both separately. That's like going to the library and like checking out, Canterbury Tales and Dante's Inferno. Once again, they're checking out like, oh, this old literature, trying to piece together this crime. If I can read us T.S. Eliot. And then there's a scene later on where Brad Pitt's character, Mills, he sent one of the underling cops, to get him a bunch of cliff notes. And so now he's versed in the class a little bit. He needs the cliff notes. If he's really going to get a handle on this case, you've got to get to the bottom of some of this Shakespeare. I thought that was pretty funny. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's like 10 of them. Yeah.
I don't think so. Not specifically.
Well, there's.
Look, I have to get Morgan Freeman's back here, because I do understand, Trent, that you could view him as kind of one note. Like, you could probably take Somerset, his character in Seven, and say that he's a lot like his character in The Shawshank Redemption.
Every movie.
But watching this movie again, like, much more focus because of the show, because, you know, we're watching these movies, I think, with a little more attention to detail than we have in the past. There's so many little things that Morgan Freeman does with his face. And the one that I think I love the most is when they're finally having like their bonding moment at Brad Pitt's apartment after Gwyneth Paltrow, Brad Pitt's wife, invites Somerset, Morgan Freeman, over for dinner. They're kind of starting to get into it together and actually have a bonding moment. And Brad Pitt's all like energetic and like, I'm going to get a beer. And he's like, you want a beer? And Morgan Freeman's like, wine. And Brad Pitt goes and gets like this regular giant water glass that you would, drink water out of, and pours him like 12 ounces of red wine.
I loved that.
A tall boy of wine.
Right before that scene cuts away and they're like, they realize, okay, they notice the eyes of a picture, and they know they have to go in the middle of the night to interview this witness again. Like just really subtly, Morgan Freeman finally kind of looks at the glass real quick and realizes that Brad Pitt gave him this fucking tumbler full of wine. There's a lot of moments like that, that I think Freeman, you know, to give him credit, just to keep it an even playing field here.
Did you guys have a favorite murder of the seven deadly sins?
I did, and I wrote it down because I was so annoyed that I was watching this movie. I did.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the sloth murder. It was great.
That was
cool
as hell. One.
I was all about the sloth murder. The whole sequence is very good, very creepy. Big ups on the sloth scene.
Yeah.
No, I watched it in my apartment on Atlantic Street on the Hill with my long ex-girlfriend Sam, and I didn't like it. I can tell you exactly. I remember specifically. I just didn't like it, and so I thought we could. She's on Facebook. I don't think she wants. I don't think she wants to hear it from any one of us. I can tell you that. But I thought I would like it more this time. Maybe like, oh, I was young. I should give it a chance. And but it was like I said, it was great laughs. I loved. I loved the Morgan Freeman line when he says, "You can lead a horse to water, but that don't make him a duck." You know, and it's like, oh man, this guy is full of wisdom.
Such a butthole.
Why? It was good. God. Well, and also, I got bullied. By the way, I just like people to know that I got bullied on this on the text thread. You know, there's a lot of awareness now about cyberbullying and a lot of toxic behavior online and shaming and stuff.
Are you kidding me?
It's so easy when you're like behind a screen, a phone, your Twitter fingers and text fingers say stuff. And I just said on the thread, I said, you know, my exact words were, I like when a stranger calls better than seven. And Kevin said, just die. And I was already having a tough day. Nate, you don't even know what's happening on the see, that's what you don't get on the other end of that screen. You don't know what someone's going through, and you told me to just die.
Very true.
I apologize.
Well,
that's my sin.
Despite your face.
Yeah, I really know it for being vain. You can tell by looking at me.
Oh, God. Did you guys know, like, not to, like, to keep this train rolling, the sloth murder was my favorite murder. The dude that played that actor was, like, 98 pounds. And they didn't tell anybody on set that he wasn't dead.
Shut up.
So all the go back and watch that scene. And it's,
the most legit
response you'll see, because Fincher didn't tell anybody, yeah, by the way, this dude's going to wake up real quick. I would have fucking died if I was on set and that fucking dude all of a sudden gasped for air. Fake guns.
Yeah. I remember the first time I watched, I guess, any part of this movie, it was on cable. It was on like TNT or something like that. And I was very young. And that was the first scene that I saw. It was like the commercial break, like, ended right before that scene. And I was just like, oh, what's this? I'm a latchkey kid. Nobody's paying attention to me and what I'm watching. And I saw that and I was just fucking horrified. It's crazy. It's definitely my favorite one.
I was kind of horrified how Mills and his wife, that's Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow, how they keep their dogs. They've just moved to New York City and they have, they appear to have three large dogs and they keep them sealed in one room with newspaper on the floor. And they don't even get to come out when they're hanging out all night going over the case and the dogs are still, what kind of life
is
that?
They never said it was New York City. They actually never give you the name of the city in this movie.
It seems like New York City. I don't know.
Do you want to know one of the most No, that's the thing about angst I wanted to bring up is, like, I mean, I had a wiener dog for over 15 years.
R.I.P. Herman.
When you watch She-Wolf.
Oh, like, God.
I couldn't believe, like, how he was, like, treating the wiener dog the entire time, like, with so much more respect than, like, a human being. I mean, he takes it with him. He brings some of his sausage out to, you know, to the car to feed him. I was like,
he's feeding him whenever.
Yeah. We had a very pet friendly week here.
Well, actually they're the PETA, the people for the ethical treatment of animals. They actually commended the house that Jack built because the duckling scene. Remember the scene as when Jack is a kid? They commended the film because it shows that sadistic behavior toward animals in younger people and children is something that should be taken very seriously and can indicate sociopathic behavior later on in life. So these are all very pet friendly films.
I mean, I wouldn't. Some pretty fucked up shit happens to that duck, albeit fake.
Yeah, that was fake. That was not a real duck.
That was
yes.
That
was it was a real duck, but
the kids were real.
The duck was real. Like if you look real close, you can see when he pulls the leg off. You can kind of see him folding the duck's real leg.
Oh yeah, no, I don't mean that the duck was a robot. I just mean he didn't really do anything to a duck.
Jurassic World.
Yeah, he did actually shoot those kids. That and that was and Peter was fine with that.
Yeah, well they don't. I mean, they're fine. I will say the real Werner Niesek or whatever killed the cat in real life at the family home. So that's a fun fact.
Dick.
What a dick.